Welcome, everyone, listeners, to the number 9 episode of the Law of Liberty podcast. And we are back, just the two of us, myself and Stratty. How you doing, my friend?
Doing pretty great. Coming off a pretty hectic week in the political world that we both decided to insert ourselves in. So we're going to talk about that this week. Going on, though, talking about other news that we have yet to talk about on this show and very relevant to what we talk about on here is the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG. David, how about you go in on this one first?
Well, you know, I have read a lot of Ginsburg decisions in my time in law school. And, you know, obviously a very smart woman, a woman who came over barriers in the legal profession to her being a woman at the time. So all of that is very admirable, and you can respect those qualities in anybody. But I think you would agree that we do not agree with her philosophy, and we don't agree with her judicial decisions, especially on things like the Commerce Clause, which we're going to get into a little bit in this episode. So, I mean, obviously respect for her in terms of her personal achievement. But it's interesting to see the reactions of people after her death, the kind of real unhinged psychoses that some of these people fell into after they learned of her death. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd ever witnessed anything like that in the death of someone who was a political figure. And what's sad is, you know, someone of her status, a judge, should not be considered a political figure, but that's America today for you. However, I do remember when Scalia passed, there was not really outcry like there was for RBG. Like, all you heard for Scalia was, like, great man, like, smart person, really cared about his job, did it well. And but with RBG dying, I'm seeing people saying, like, this is what really is going to make our democracy fall, and this is what's really going to divide America, and this is, I don't get it. Why her? Like, why is it because she was the first woman Supreme Court justice?
Well, she wasn't the first. O'Connor was the first.
That's right. I mean, yeah, that's right. You're right.
But why the first?
So why does everyone make such a big deal about RBG then? Like, I don't get it.
Well, I think it's simply just because of the way she would rule and the fact that she was very much in favor of big government control of the economy. And also she was in favor of left-wing social values. Like abortion and other things like that. And so I think that this is a really, and this is something you just mentioned too, this is a really great opportunity for us to recognize the politics at play in all of this. You know, sometimes in your civics 101 class, the propaganda teacher will say, well, the courts are the non-political branch and they're supposed to be above politics. And I mean, that's such a lie. I mean, first of all, the president and the Senate appoint and confirm the nominees. And so those are political figures. So that just right there, I mean, we have political process in the nomination process. So to say that the court is completely out of the purview of politics is simply absurd. And so I think that this is a really great opportunity for us to recognize that and to recognize that these courts, these justices, they're political creatures too. And, you know, to think that they're above that is blindness, I think. And I think that we're really seeing played out how these political and culture wars are really dividing this country. And when one single person in one position of power can cause this kind of an uproar amongst millions of people, I think that's when you know that you've got too much power concentrated in one place.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that, and an even bigger divisive issue that has come about because of this is Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, and there's a lot of talk about her from both sides, both good and bad. But again, I don't get why this is an issue that should shake up the country so much. I get why the Supreme Court is a huge issue for the American people as a whole. It really shouldn't be. And I get why, you know, we might want to focus on these issues. What I don't get is, yes, they are politicized, but how can they be politicized to this point where it's not them, it's us. Us falling for it is the whole majority of the people in America are falling for it. They don't realize if we simply wouldn't comply with dumb laws or stuff that they want to make up because of their judicial review, it wouldn't mean anything. And so I think people are falling for their tricks, and I think the elites, which RBG and the Supreme Court is a part of, they want that, and on both sides, right and left. They want us to think they have this kind of power over us and that it does matter, when in reality, we should realize ourselves, no, like, no one really does have power over us if we just simply say, no, you don't, and that idea spreads. But going back to Amy Coney Barrett, I think this is going to be a very interesting talk because there's a lot of things to get into here. I know you have some things you want to bring up, and I have some things I want to bring up and discuss. If you wanted to wait and go for RBG first and talk about the Commerce Clause, I'm up for that. Whatever you want to do, David.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about Barrett first because I want to build more off of the point I was making before about the politics of all of this. And I think that one of the things that we'll get into more is how democracy corrupts everything, and this idea of democracy and it also ties into what you said a little bit was how people are saying, oh, the death of RBG is going to be the death of democracy. And, you know, the problem with that kind of view is, well, first of all, democracy is not great and is not the ideal, and it is not the system which we have. We do not have a democracy. We have a republic with democratic features. So I think that, you know, this it definitely plays into the democracy propaganda, because as we'll get to with the Commerce Clause with RBG, you know, they want us to think that we have democratic political control over the regulations that Congress makes over the market. And, you know, they're replacing our market democracy with political democracy, which obviously has plenty of problems, you know, just because of the flaws of democracy. Hoppe and other people have done great work on talking about that. And also part of this, all of this, is that, you know, this democratic aspect just has all this politics getting into the courts. And we're seeing that really play out with Barrett. And I wanted to talk about first kind of the political aspect of why Trump picked her above others. And I think that one thing that's important to remember is how this is all happening right before the election. I mean, this all goes back to the election, because the Democrats want to rig it, and Trump is, you know, trying to do what he can to fight against these deep state goons who are trying to claim democracy when they're, you know, making fake ballots or whatever the heck they're going to try to do. And Barrett was a Scalia protege.
Mm-hmm.
And Scalia was the justice who wrote the opinion in Bush versus Gore. And Bush versus Gore was the case where Al Gore sued in order to get a recount in Florida. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, I can't exactly remember the reasons. I think there was an equal protections reason and some other statutory reason. But basically the court in that case said, no, we're not going to do a recount. And that's what gave Bush Florida. And that's what pushed him over the Electoral College threshold to get elected. And so I think that what Trump is kind of thinking is, well, Barrett is a Scalia protege, and I think she might have had something to do with Bush versus Gore at the time. She might have been on the legal team. I can't remember whether or not that's true. But whether or not it's true, I think that what Trump is thinking is that if Barrett gets on the court, which probably will happen, they have the votes in the Senate, she might rule in his favor on a possible recount litigation. And I think that is the main political thing that Trump's thinking about.
See, and that theory makes sense to me because it makes perfect sense. Because, yeah, I mean, doing research, I found out, yeah, she was a Scalia protege. And my immediate thinking doing this research was that Trump picked her because she's basically a Scalia 2.0. So Scalia, he wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong here, but he was an originalist, right?
Scalia, yes. I mean, he was kind of a mix of textualist and originalist. He'd probably, I've heard him say different things at different times, but I'd say that he's a textualist plus. Where he starts with the text, he focuses on the text, but he interprets the text based on the understanding at the time.
So that makes even more sense as to why Trump would see or Trump and others would see Barrett as a Scalia 2.0, because I saw where she herself had said she identifies as an originalist, yet all of her peers peg her as a textualist, and I found that very interesting. And I, going off subject a little real quick, just a quick question. How often does that happen in y'all's legal circles where, you know, there, someone may have a mixed identity as a originalist or textualist, or there's some controversy there?
Well, I think it happens a lot because textualism, I think, in its purest sense, is really tough to apply fully, because if you don't have at least some aspect of originalism in there, then just reading the bare text alone without context doesn't help, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like the whole point of text is that the text was written in a context, and that context is the originalism aspect. And so the full originalism beyond the textualism would say something like, well, we just have to go on the original intent. Whereas the textualism would say we have to go on the meaning that a reasonable person would have at the time. So it's not focusing on the intent. It's more focusing on what would a reasonable person have understood at the time. And so I guess the main difference between the textualism and the originalism would be the focusing on the intent there. And Scalia is very clear that he, especially when he's reading legislation, statutes, newer statutes, He doesn't care at all about the intent. He says garbage in, garbage out. If you write a law and the text of the law doesn't affect what you wanted it to, he doesn't care. He's going to say that's the legislature's job to write the law upright. And once they send it to me, I apply what it says. I don't care what you intended, because if you couldn't write it down in a way to conform to what you intended, then that's your problem. It's not mine. I'm not the legislature. You are. And I agree with all that. I mean, I think that's a very strong argument. And also part of the argument, too, is that what is ratified through the legislature is the text. The arguments leading up to passage were not passed. The committee reports were not passed. What was passed was the text of the law. And so the argument there would be, well, if you're applying anything other than the text of the law, then you're not applying what was passed, and therefore you're violating the Constitution. And so I think that's a strong constitutional argument there for textualism that a Scalia type would go for. But anyway, yeah, back to your original question. I think that a little seed of originalism always has to lie with the textualism. So I think that the key difference would be whether or not we're taking into account intent. And Scalia tried to shy away from that as much as he possibly could.
So with that, then, because we've been referring to Barrett as a Scalia 2.0 type, and with what you just said about Scalia, I wanted to ask then, because that put this thought to my mind. One of the things I noticed about Barrett, and I did a lot of research on, was her views on marriage and government. And obviously, she's a Catholic woman, so she believes that marriage is between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
You know, nothing wrong with that. You know, people are allowed to view marriages however they want. A lot of people are scared about this, though, and that she would try and overturn the Obergefell decision. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right.
Obergefell.
Obergefell, yeah. So there's fear that she would try and get overturned because she had written in 2015 about Chief Justice John Roberts' dissent. She wrote this. In his dissent, said those who want same. In his dissent, Justice Roberts said those who want same-sex marriage, you have every right to lobby in state legislatures to make that happen. But the dissent's view was that it wasn't for the court to decide. So I think Obergefell and what we're talking about for the future of the court, it's really a who decides question. So before I get in on this, because I have some thoughts on that on my own, I wanted to ask you, does that match up with what Scalia said? I'm not too clear.
Yes, that does match up with what Scalia said. Scalia was very much, and this is an idea that I wanna keep in people's heads, this idea of judicial restraint. And I have a quote from Barrett that we might get to in a little bit, talking about the Obamacare case where she talks about this. But the idea is that with social issues like marriage, like the death penalty, Scalia will say, well, look back at the founding of the country and the Constitution. Look at the marriage laws at the time. Or, well, okay, that's not the best example because the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War. The 14th Amendment has a due process clause where it says that liberty cannot be taken away without due process of law. So that was passed in the 1800s. And so the thought is, what did liberty mean at the time it was passed? That's what the Scalia type would say. Scalia would say, the word liberty in this context, in the 14th Amendment passed at the time, what did it mean then? Because that's what the word meant. And so what the Scalia type would say is, well, in the 1860s, they were not putting in the 14th Amendment that liberty meant the right to gay marriage. And they'd also be saying that in the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment, that the laws must apply equally. They'd say that, well, also at the time, you know, gay marriage wasn't something that was considered to be a part of that. Because no states at the time, you know, recognized gay marriage or whatever. And so because the state practice at the time would show that they weren't considering gay marriage to be something that was under the purview of this amendment, then Scalia would say that that issue was retained to the democratic political process. The courts cannot take those words that were written at that time and then say, well, now we think that this is what these words mean. And that's the living constitution types. That's the Ruth Bader Ginsburg types.
Yeah, I was about to say, we see that a lot.
Right. They're the ones who say, well, liberty, as we define it now in the 14th Amendment, is something that means differently than what the people who passed it meant at the time.
Yeah.
And so that's why they'll be talking about how that's why the Scalia types will say, this is taking away the sovereignty of the people through the democratic process, because these issues were not taken out of the democratic process by the amendment, but the court is taking them out of the democratic process by incorrectly interpreting the amendment. That's what the Scalia types would say. And that's basically, you know, what the dissenters of Obergefell would say. So, yes, and you know, and I think this argument has some merits and some bad points. I mean, like I said before, neither of us trust democracy. So I really, you know, don't care about the people's democratic process, whatever, because I think that democracy just leads to destruction.
Yeah.
And I do believe that people have a right to association. And I think that that broad right basically just includes the right to gay marriage. And, you know, I don't want the government involved in marriage at all. And I don't think the government really should be involved or can be involved in marriage at all.
But I also, okay, I have another thing, though, because you you said something I wanted to say, which is, yes, government should not have anything to do with marriage. Government did not create marriage. Marriage was created by the church. It should stay with church. Church should have should be the one who administers marriage and chooses who can be married and not. And I don't really have an opinion on who should and who shouldn't be married. I just think it should be left up to the people who made the thing of marriage itself, and that's the church. Yeah. And so if Obergefell were to be overturned,
which I don't think it will be. I don't see that as any reasonable possibility at all. I think that people who are saying that it will be are just ginning up a reaction. I really don't think that's possible.
No, and I agree with you, and I think it's the same with another one we'll talk about here in a minute. But
Roe versus Wade.
We'll talk about that here in a minute. But if Obergefell were to be overturned, then could like it would just return to the way it was beforehand, right? Where gay marriage was a state's rights issue.
I guess that I suppose so, but I mean anything could happen. I mean they wouldn't necessarily need to revert back to the old precedent. They could just make a new thing, which could be totally different. So I mean that it's possible that we could just revert to the way things were before, but I don't think that's a necessity from overturning Obergefell.
Okay, I was just curious because I'm not too sure what kind of effects overturning something like that would have or what would happen.
I think it would. I think it would be a movement back towards the states' rights thing. But yeah, I mean, and I'll say too that I don't even necessarily agree that that would be a good thing, because it's like I don't think that a majority of people in a state should be able to vote to decide who can and can't live with each other based on their own free choice, and who can and can't get married or engage in some civil agreement contract to say, hey, you know, I get, you know, this is my partner, you know, so we get spousal immunity in litigation. Because that's one of the main things about Obergefell. Marriage, and this is why getting the state involved in marriage is such a ridiculous thing, is that marriage has legal ramifications that come with it. And so if you're married and you're prosecuted for a crime, you have spousal immunity, which means that you can talk to your spouse and your spouse can hide information from the authorities without being criminally liable. Or other kind of things like with schools and emergency contacts, if a gay couple has a child and one of the parents can't pick up, if like the, you know, let's say there's two women who are married or who are partners, and then one of them has an artificial insemination and they give birth to the child. And so they're the birth mother, and then the other one is the mother as well, raising in the home. Well, if they're not legally married, then there might be problems, say, if at school, if the biological mother wasn't able to pick the kid up or wasn't able to take the kid to some function, then the other parent would have to do that. But if they weren't legally married, they might not be given the legal right to do those kind of parent things with the child. And so that's another just shows how getting the state involved in these things, you know, corrupts all of it. Because then you have a political process saying, hey, you lesbian couple or you gay couple, you can't do all those things. When all we would have to do is just say, hey, if you have a, it wouldn't even have to be a marriage. It would just be a contract that you make with somebody to say, hey, in these cases, when I can't pick my kid up from school or when I'm sick or whatever, you have responsibility for my children. And that's it. It's like you could just lay out in a contract all of the things that go along with marriage. And we wouldn't need to have the government and people voting on whether or not a couple could set their arrange their affairs with their family as they deem fit, you know. And that would just avoid so much of the culture war problems and so much of the problems of the court forcing their cultural views on people. We could just have a blanket live or let live right of association, and then all of these particular rights that substantive due process like gay marriage and stuff, those would all just be covered without having to force it down people's throats. And so I think this kind of shows how the court has gone wrong in protecting our liberties. By claiming to protect our liberties, they're just chalking our liberties up to this to either the political process or setting them up in a way that causes cultural conflict. And I think that either way is very dangerous.
So yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, talking about the culture wars, that's a subject that libertarians in general love to talk about. And I think the Supreme Court is the biggest, what's the word? It's the biggest force in the culture war because, like you just
said.
Or
at least one of the biggest.
Yeah, one of the biggest forces because their opinions hold a lot of weight.
For everybody.
Yeah,
and
for everybody.
It's like a one-size-fits-all.
And it has great effects throughout the country in every single small town to all the big cities, from your most, you know, conservative uncle to your most liberal aunt. They're all affected by their decisions. So the Supreme Court is definitely a big force in the culture wars and one of the biggest tidal waves in the culture wars in America specifically came with Roe v. Wade. And the reason I wanted to bring up Roe v. Wade and Amy Coney Barrett is because in 2013, Barrett, she wrote an article for, while we're talking about Amy Coney Barrett, is because I found a 2013 article from the Texas Law Review written by her. And it's about the doctrine of the stare decisis.
Stare decisis.
Can you explain that for our listeners really quick?
Yes, so stare decisis is a Latin term that means the decision stands, and that is a doctrine in the common law and in the Supreme Court that past decisions hold weight, and we should follow them. And so, obviously, the Supreme Court is free to not follow its precedent, and it has done that on many occasions. But basically, what stare decisis says is that the default position is to follow the rulings of decisions that came before. Mm-hmm. And so that's why courts will cite cases when they're making their arguments for how to rule in a certain case. They'll say, hey, this is what we've ruled before. These are the rules that we follow. And here's why we're going to, you know, follow them. And so it's not something that can't ever be overcome, but it's definitely something that the courts very, very much look to in deciding how to rule on a case is how past cases were ruled.
So while we're talking about, you know, again, we're going to get into the fact that the courts are political here because it's something that she wrote in her own statement. In 2013, Barrett wrote this article on what David just explained in Texas Law Review, and it was going over cases that the Supreme Court had decided in that she believed should never be overturned. Well, one notable exception, obviously, was Roe v. Wade, and in explaining why it was excluded, she referenced scholarship agreeing that in order to qualify as a super precedent, a decision must have had widespread support from not only jurists, but politicians and the public at large, to the extent of becoming immune to reversal or challenge. She argued the people must trust the ruling's validity to such an extent the matter has been taken off of the court's agenda, with lower courts no longer taking challenges to them seriously. Barrett pointed to Planned Parenthood versus Casey. I don't know that case, but she pointed to it as evidence that Roe had not yet attained this status. She's never ruled directly on abortion, but she did hear a vote to rehear a successful challenge to Indiana's parental notification law in 2019. For what she said about, you know, there's no super president for Roe v. Wade, I want to ask, what do you think about that? And is there any kind of politics, in your opinion, that go into play there?
Okay. Well, yeah, I definitely think that there is a lot of politics. I've never heard this quote from her before, but it's interesting. It seems as though she is trying to say that even if the court has made some ruling and has, at least on the face of the matter, has taken the issue outside of the realm of politics, which is what Roe versus Wade did by holding that there's a substantive due process right to privacy. And within the right to privacy, women have a right to I think it was first trimester abortions in Roe versus Wade. Now, with the other case that you brought up, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Casey was basically an update of Roe. And so what Casey did is it created a let me see here. I'm looking at my notes. Yeah, so basically what the court said in Casey is that instead of drawing the line at the first trimester, which is what Roe did, they say that we're going to draw the line at viability. And so that could be after the first trimester. So basically that the abortion right goes up until the point that the fetus is viable outside of the womb. And they also laid down what they called an undue burden test, which basically means that there cannot be substantial obstacles in purpose or effect to a woman getting an abortion of a non-viable fetus. And so basically what was happening in Casey was that there were these laws that were putting up regulations on the way that abortion clinics had to do their work. They had to meet specifications up to the levels of hospitals. And also there was some regulations on where abortion clinics could be located, which caused rural women who lived in rural areas to have to travel long distances. There was also a regulation that said that after you inform a woman about abortion and her options, you have to give her at least 24 hours to think about it before she gets the abortion. So it's like if she comes in for a consultation on a possible abortion, you can't do it that day. You have to tell her about her options, and then she has to go 24 hours before she can say yes and get the abortion. So basically what Casey was saying was that we're going to extend Roe to viability rather than the first trimester of when the right to abortion ends. And we're also going to have this undue burden test that says that the government cannot put up substantial obstacles to getting an abortion before viability, which would include these regulations that they were putting on abortion clinics. And so basically with Roe plus Casey, so Casey didn't overrule Roe, it just kind of changed it a little bit, and it said that there's a fundamental qualified substantive due process right to abort before viability with no government interference. No actual impingement of this right is needed to be proven for a statute to be invalid, and that before viability, the undue burdens test applies to restrictions on abortions. After viability, government may regulate and ban abortion. I think that there is, it's interesting what Barrett's trying to do here, because it seems like she's trying to say that even after the court takes something out of the democratic process, such as they were doing with Roe and Casey, there's still, she says that there's still some time after a decision like that where the people can let their desires be known about whether or not they agree with this. And so that's an interesting argument. It's basically saying that the decision itself isn't enough for stare decisis. There has to be a decision plus widespread agreement. And I think that's probably a good argument. I mean, I think that that's probably the way that things actually work a lot of the times in the court's jurisprudence. I mean, look at a case like, Korematsu, where the court upheld the detention of Japanese Americans during World War II. I mean, that was the law, and that case has not been officially overturned, so it is still precedent. But the court said in Trump versus Hawaii in dicta, which basically dicta is just the court saying something in a case and it's not binding law, but they're just kind of giving their opinion on something, but it's not binding. And in Trump versus Hawaii, which was a challenge to Trump's travel ban, what the court said was that Korematsu is not something that we're going to enforce, but they weren't directly overruling it. So it kind of seems to me that this is something that just happens. If there's a case that's laid down in precedent, but the people don't agree with it, or the court doesn't agree with it anymore, or some things have changed, or we realize that it was wrong when we ruled on it, then that can be overturned. And that's a part of the way stare decisis works. So I think she might. So I think and I think this ties into what we were saying about Scalia too, where he wants to protect the democratic process from the court taking things out of it. This might be her trying to say there's still a role for politics to play in determining what type of judicial outcomes we want, even after the court makes some decision that gets set down in precedent. And I think that that's probably the way things actually work a lot of the times, and how precedent gets overruled, which happens a lot. And I'll point out before turning it over to you that it's interesting how Barrett is making this argument by appealing to Roe versus Wade and Casey. And as I said before, Casey did not overturn Roe in the sense of the right to abortion. It modified Roe, it modified the standard that we use to analyze regulations on abortions, but it upheld the right to get an abortion. So that's the whole crux of the matter. I mean, the other tangential issues are obviously important as well, but the key thing, the right to get an abortion or not, that was upheld in Casey. So to appeal to Casey and saying that Roe is not super precedent because Casey modified it, well, the thing that was modified wasn't the right to the abortion. It was just more tangential issues. So I think that that's interesting. I think Barrett is right in general with her argument about the stare decisis and super precedent stuff. But I don't think, even if that argument is right, that it would apply to Roe, because the right to abortion aspect of it has not been overturned in any way. I mean, like I said, Casey slightly modified the ancillary issues, but the right to abortion itself was reaffirmed, and I think stands strong in the court's eyes.
I mean, yeah, and I think I agree with you, and I think she has a unique point of view there. But I want to comment on something going back to what you said earlier when we were talking about gay marriage being a state's rights issue, and I agree with you. You know, I don't want that to be left up to people voting on whether or not people can have a voluntary peaceful association just because they're the same sex or not. So, to me though, I think abortion is a much touchier situation. You know, you could find some people that don't like abortion themselves, but would agree that government shouldn't rule over our bodies. And I tend to take that position. However, you may find some people who would say the body within the woman, that body has its own right to liberty, to life, and all that. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that abortion should be more of a state's rights issue, or do you like Roe v. Wade being what it is because it at least gives individuals their right to do this? However, I don't have any problem with a woman making her own decision about her body. However, I can see where Roe v. Wade had a lot of cultural impact in America, and that hurt America in ways, and also why people do have problems with it and don't want to live in a nation that has that, or a community just that has that. So do you see any kind of difference between those two issues, where it's probably good that Roe v. Wade is upheld by the Supreme Court, or it should be just a states' rights issue? Because I noticed that you said, you know, you do kind of like that gay rights is held up by the Supreme Court because you don't want states to be able to vote on someone's peaceful association. So what do you think about that? That's a lot more wordier than I could have.
Yeah, no. I get your main question, and it's a tough one for me, because I do believe that people should have the right to say, hey, I want to live in this community, and I want to associate with these people, and part of our agreement is that we don't agree with abortion for religious reasons, for cultural reasons, for whatever. But I also think that in itself is not the same as saying we have 51% majority in this state, and therefore we're going to force the other 49% to conform. So I think it's tough. What I would like to see is I would like to see a broader, more general freedom of association upheld by the courts, which I think is established as a right that we have based on logic and based on the history of the United States and, you know, being a country with a culture based on individualism and general free markets. You know, I think that there is ideas there that you know, people have the right to freedom of association and freedom of contract. And so I think I'd like to see a more general right of just freedom of association, because that would include those different kind of rights, like, you know, like the right to contract for an abortion or other things like that. Does that mean I think that abortion's a good thing? No, not necessarily. But I think that it's something that free people should be able to decide whether or not they like it. And I don't think that politics is the right way to do that, because politics is force. But I also don't think that the court is the right way to do that, because it's just a panel of 9 people who are elitist, who are making a decision like that on how the rest of the country has to associate with others, and how what their tax dollars are going to be used for, and what kind of policies are going to be implemented by the government. So I don't think that either way is the right way to go. I think that the court would be much better served and would be much less of a force in the culture war if we just accepted a basic freedom of association, because that would basically just cover all the other stuff. So I think that I would ultimately just like to see the court just have a right to freedom of association, and I think that that would save us from the politics of it. And I also think it would save us from the culture war forced association aspect of it.
Yeah, I think that's the best way of going about it as well, because that's the only true way where every single individual can get the outcome they wish for. And we can all still be, as I like to say, thriving in our indifferent coexistence, our peaceful indifferent coexistence. So before I ask you my big question for you on Amy Barrett, you had something you brought up, and something I've seen a lot of libertarians posting about, and a big reason why people are excited for Barrett being our possible next Supreme Court justice, and that was her, I believe, dissent saying that felons should be allowed to own guns. Why don't you talk about that a bit, since you did more research on that than I did?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like, before we get into that, I'd just like to have one more point before that I'd like to bring up, just on something about the politics of all of this, and then I'll switch over to the Second Amendment issue. We were talking about her Catholicism, and I myself am not Catholic. I went to a Catholic school for a few years, and some of my closest friends are Catholics. And I think it's really interesting how the religious Catholic aspect has played out. Especially in her first confirmation, when Trump appointed her to the Seventh Circuit federal courts, and when Dianne Feinstein was grilling Barrett in her confirmation hearings about her Catholicism. And I think it's really interesting how the Democrats have kind of been pushing her Catholicism as being somehow disqualifying for her. And I think that's very fascinating of how political and cultural this kind of stuff is. I think that's just an interesting point of how we've gotten to the point where somebody's religion is disqualifying, especially a Catholic. You know, like, we can't have a Catholic on the court. You know, that's interesting, you know.
And that's very ironic too, because it's like are our own Supreme Court justices not allowed their First Amendment rights as well? Like,
exactly. It's very, 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 very strange. And so I think that's just something interesting to point out. And also, I think that another thing, and this one was the one that actually kind of got me mad, because I don't know Amy Barrett. I've never met her. I don't know her personally. I'm going to assume she's a very lovely woman.
Is it about the kids?
And it's about the kids.
Yeah.
When people were talking about the whole adoption issue with her two adopted children from Haiti, and how they're basically trying to say, I don't know if people, I mean, I'm sure some people did. Some people were a little bit more surreptitious about it, but they were basically saying that, well, it's not unheard of that racist people would adopt black children.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and this is something that really gets me personally, because I have an aunt and an uncle who adopted two children from Uganda.
Yeah.
And I love those kids. They are amazing, and they're growing up. And I'm trying to get them into the Austrian economics. I got them some kiddie books on on markets and Mises from the Mises Institute. So I'm trying to work my way in there. But they're just great kids. And, you know, my aunt and uncle, they got married late, and they were past the age of childbearing, and they didn't have any children, and they felt called by God to adopt and to take somebody from a unprivileged place and to give them a better chance at life and to raise them and to love them and to give them what they deserve. And so it really made me mad when you have these people who are supposed to be anti-racist, but all they think about is race, and all they think about is how can we take anything like this, I just think the right thing to assume is that she just wanted to help these kids.
Yeah.
And that she just probably felt called by God to do something like that and to help them, and to just try to spin this politically and into something that shows how she's unfit or is a bad person. I think it's just that's absolutely the lowest we could go.
Yeah. I mean, and another thing to say about that is, like, I mean, I didn't read anything about Barrett's personal opinion on abortion. I assume, and I'm very sure, she doesn't care for it. But what's ironic is the people attacking her for adopting black children, they are the ones that advocate for abortion, and they usually tell people who are pro-life that, well, why don't you adopt? And now they're giving her flack for adopting.
Yeah.
And it made me angry too, because I just don't see how you could judge someone, you could attack their character just because they adopted a child of a different color. I don't see how that's a mark against them at all, and why that should be criticized.
It's absurd. It's worse than absurd. It's despicable.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because it just kind of shows all the ridiculous hysteria that politics causes.
Yeah. Yep, it shows the depth of depravity that politics sends us to when we're just fighting over this violent system. It's sad, honestly.
Well, I want to get back to the, you know, what we were talking about, her dissent on felons and why they should own guns. And like I said, you did more research on that. So how about you talk about that one?
Yeah. So there was a case which Amy Coney Barrett was one of three judges that presided over this case in an appeal. And it's a case called Cantor versus Barr. And in the case, the issue was about a law from Wisconsin. I believe it was Wisconsin. And the law said that felons are not allowed by the statute to own firearms. To own a weapon like that. And the two other judges, who I believe were Reagan appointees, older judges who have been around for a while, they both ruled in the majority that the law was constitutional, that the Wisconsin law, which held that all felons cannot bear a firearm, they held that that law did not violate the Second Amendment. Barrett dissented, and she said that the law violated the Constitution, violated the Second Amendment, because it made no distinction between violent and nonviolent felons. She said, and let me see if I can pull up her her quote from the very beginning of it, because it was very powerful language and something that made me think that at least on this gun issue, she's going to be a very good justice. Let me see if I can find it here.
Which
here
we need.
Yes, which we absolutely need.
And I also, I wanted to say, like, part of me thinks Trump may be strategizing to get more of a libertarian vote by nominating her, because I'm sure he's caught on to the fact that people have caught on to his BS when he talks about loving gun rights, because it's the same person who set out to ban bump stocks and said take the guns first, due process second. So I think part of his strategizing could be nominating this woman so he could get that libertarian vote, but whatever, I'll take it, I guess. I like my gun rights.
let's look at her quote here. She says, and this is the very first thing she says in her dissent. As, quote, "History is consistent with common sense. It demonstrates that legislatures have the power to prohibit dangerous people from possessing guns. But that power extends only to people who are dangerous. Founding era legislatures did not strip felons of the right to bear arms simply because of their status as felons. Nor have the parties introduced any evidence that founding era legislatures imposed virtue-based restrictions on the right. Such restrictions applied to civic rights like voting and jury service, not to individual rights like the right to possess a gun. In 1791, and for well more than a century afterward, legislatures disqualified categories of people from the right to bear arms only when they judged that doing so was necessary to protect the public safety." So what she's saying is, first I'll point out, is that she's going full originalist here. I mean, she's going back to 1791. She's going back to say, what was our understanding of the Second Amendment at the time?
Yeah.
So she's going the textualist, she's going to originalist, which I think is a good sign. And basically she goes on to say that this law was unconstitutional because this particular felon in the case, he was a felon for mail fraud. He did not assault anybody. He didn't, no grand theft. No break and entering, you know, no burglary, no nothing like that. No battery or violence. He just mail fraud. And so she said that because this guy's felony was a nonviolent felony, he still has the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. So what she's saying is that felony status alone is not enough to take away somebody's Second Amendment right. They have to be a violent felon. And that was her ruling in that dissent.
In a comment I want to make on that is, and the first thought that jumped into my mind is, I mean, I love that dissent. And if her thinking was applied to how the gun laws work now, so many minorities would be better off and would be able to defend themselves, because it's a sad truth that a lot of minorities become felons because of nonviolent crimes like possession of marijuana. Or just dealing. So I really love that. And I think that if she gets the nod, and if she's able to ever have an impact on our gun rights through the Supreme Court, it'll be positive. And that's something we need more and more of, is more self-defense, especially with the way America's going now for both black and white, left and right, you know? So, yeah, I think that's a net positive. I want to go on to talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because that's the other big topic for this episode. So before I ask you, though, my big question, do you have any more comments on Barrett you want to make?
Yeah, I got a few things I want to point out. Before we leave the guns issue, I'll just say, that there was another case I found. I didn't read all the way through it, but it was called United States versus Cherry. And in that case, I believe Barrett ruled with the other two judges, and I think they all agreed that there is no such thing as a innocent possessor defense for felons in possession of a firearm. And so I think in this case, she basically agreed that there's nowhere in precedent that says that a felon who is innocently in possession of a firearm, that's not a defense to that possession. So I needed to look more into that case. I didn't dive too deeply into it, but that might be something where we can maybe say, okay, you know, maybe there are some cases where she might not give somebody the benefit of the doubt in regards to some innocent possession of a firearm. But I mean, there are exceptions in cases of, you know, like you're about to die. So if you're being violently assaulted and you're about to die, and even if you're a felon, if you pick up the gun and defend yourself, that's not gonna, like, you, that is a defense to a felon in possession. But just like accidentally picking up a gun or something like that, innocent possession, they said that that's not a defense. Like I said, I didn't get too much into the case, but that just might be something to kind of qualify our kind of views on how she'll rule in gun cases. She just seems to be going with precedent there. So I don't know exactly what to take from that, but I think that's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is really the first, well, I guess Kavanaugh, but Kavanaugh was, his, you know, nomination was, it was a facade. It was ruined because of all the hysteria that came up because of his nomination. So this is the first one I really paid attention to where I looked at the nominee's career. And I got to say, she seems like quite a quagmire. And that is why I wanted to ask this question. Do you think her, if she is to be nominated, do you think it would be a net positive for libertarians or the people in the liberty movement, or a net negative? Because I'm seeing a lot of libertarians already express so much love for her. And I feel like, you know, a lot of people didn't know who this lady was until 2 weeks ago. And also, it just seems a bit too soon to jump all over this woman and praise her. So I wanted to ask you, because you're the expert here, what do you think will be the outcome for the Liberty Movement if she's to get the nod?
Well, that's a tough question, and I really don't know. I mean, because things are so complex, I mean, even if she has a net positive effect, we might not see it, because yeah, it might be outweighed by other negative effects from other places. So it's difficult to say. I will say that I'm optimistic. I think I am optimistic, and I think that also it's a compared to what question.
Yeah.
Well, Barrett, compared to what? Ginsburg? Well,
yeah.
I'm taking Barrett. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
We're all taking Barrett.
So, you know, I think we gotta remain realistic with our expectations. And so I think at the end, compared to Ginsburg, it probably will be a positive. It might be more likely to be. But I want to reserve judgment, because we won't really know until we see how she starts ruling on cases. I think another point that can maybe inform whether or not we think that she will be good is some things that she said about Obamacare and the Obamacare case. And I found a quote from an article which she wrote, I believe, in 2017.
Yeah, I meant to bring this up as well, because I actually did find it. But you go ahead.
Yeah, and so we have this article from the Minnesota Law Review, I believe. And I think the copy I found online is a draft. I'm not sure, but in one of the sections, she talks about judicial restraint, and this is kind of something we've been talking about here. Is like the relationship of the court to politics, how many issues should the court leap to politics, and what does it mean for what's the court's proper role in reviewing legislation? How much deference should the court give to legislatures on on their propositions on how this law will work out, or what the purpose of this law is, or whether or not the law will actually meet the purposes that we say we want it to meet. These are all really interesting questions on how the court should handle itself, and what the relationship of the court to the other branches of government should be. And in this paper, she brings up Obamacare, and she talks a little bit about Randy Barnett, who's a great libertarian legal theorist. And I want to read a quote from this article. She says, quote, "Our Republican Constitution," and that's the name of Barnett's book, "Our Republican Constitution is animated in large part by Barnett's frustration with what he regards as a misguided attachment to judicial restraint, particularly on the part of conservatives. In NFIB versus Sebelius, which is the Obamacare case, the inspiration for Barnett's book, Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. So basically what happened in Sebelius was that they made Obamacare. They had this, what was called an individual mandate, which was basically a amount of money that somebody had to pay if they did not get health insurance.
Well, they didn't have to pay. It was forcibly taken away from them.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So basically what it was saying was that if you don't get health insurance, then there is this payment that you have to make. And so the government went to the court and was like, hey, our main argument is that this is a penalty. It's a penalty for not buying health insurance. And that's what the law said. In the text of the law, the law itself presented itself. And then what Roberts did was Roberts said, well, what the text of the statute says some provision is not the end all be all of what the provision actually is. We have to look at what the effects of the thing of the provision are. We have to look at the context of the provision and other kind of factors to decide what it really is. And so basically it's saying that what the government says the provision is isn't necessarily what it is. And so what he said was that even though the statute calls it a penalty, even though the government says it's a penalty, we're going to call it a tax, because it has tax-like features. It's administered through the IRS. You pay it with your taxes. You pay the penalty with your taxes. So basically, Roberts said, even though it's not purporting to be a tax, we're going to call it a tax because it has tax-like features, which is enough. And so basically, Roberts rewrote the law in order to save it based on this doctrine that the court has, where they're basically like, If we have a reasonable interpretation of a statute that will save it from being unconstitutional, then we should go with the reasonable interpretation of the statute that makes it constitutional, because we don't want to assume the worst about the legislature. We want to assume and give deference to the legislature that the laws they're passing are actually constitutional, and we should only hold them unconstitutional when there's no other reasonable way to interpret it. And so what Barrett is saying here, and I'll say it again, in NFIB versus Sebelius, Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. So she's saying that even if you accept that all of that legal framework I just laid out is true, it doesn't apply because this wasn't a reasonable interpretation of the statute, which I agree with. And she goes on to say, he construed the penalty imposed on those without health insurance as a tax, which permitted him to sustain the statute as a valid exercise of the taxing power. Had he treated the payment as the statute did, as a penalty, he would have had to invalidate the statute as lying beyond Congress's commerce power. So this was a key thing, was that the commerce power, under the commerce power, they can't force people to buy things. You can regulate what people are buying, but you can't force people to engage in commerce. You can only regulate their pre-existing engagements in commerce. You can't force them to engage in commerce. So that's why if it's a penalty, then what you're saying is that we are using the commerce power to force you to buy health insurance that you weren't buying before. And if you don't, we're going to penalize you. That's unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. But if it's a tax, then it is constitutional because the taxing power allows you to tax activity and non-activity. So that's the sleight of hand that Roberts did. By calling it a tax, it saved the statute from the unconstitutionality that was on its face. And so then she continues and says, quote, Barnett vehemently objects to the idea that a commitment to judicial restraint, understood as deference to Democratic majorities, can justify a judicial refusal to interpret the law as written. So she's getting into here in kind of the relation between how much democracy do we want here, how much of the court do we want here. You know, this is all tying into some of the issues that you even brought up, you know, about this kind of issue. And I have another highlighted quote here, and I'll read it out. Quote, Barnett is surely right that deference to a Democratic majority should not supersede a judge's duty to apply clear text. That is true, incidentally, even if one subscribes to the collective view of popular sovereignty. For a judge who adopts an interpretation inconsistent with the text fails to enforce the statute that commanded majority support. That also ties back to what I said before. It's the text which is ratified by the representatives who were elected by the majority. So only the text is what we need to apply, which Roberts wasn't doing. He was going beyond the text. And then she concludes, if the majority did not enact a tax, interpreting the statute to impose a tax lacks democratic legitimacy. So it's just an interesting issue of, first, I'll say that it's great that she doesn't like the Obamacare tax decision. Fantastic. It was a horrible decision, and Obamacare is a nightmare, and we need to do away with it. I think that's a good positive there, too. But also, it's just an interesting issue of how that ties into the whole judicial restraint issue. And, like, does judicial restraint mean deferring to the legislature in the sense of making the statute constitutional, even though it doesn't look it on its face, which is what Roberts did? Or does judicial restraint mean actually just applying the text and not worrying about those other factors? And that's an interesting issue. What's the true judicial restraint there? How are we actually going to look at the proper way for judges to restrain themselves? Is it just blind deference to the legislature? Or is it a hardline commitment to the text? And I think she has a good argument there that it has to be the latter rather than the former.
Yeah, I was about to say, just going off what you said, I think she does have a good argument there. I didn't get that much into reading about her opinion on the individual mandate, but I did read about what you just said, and I mean, anything to get rid of that, anything to get rid of Obamacare. Yeah. I agree with what you said, that I'm optimistic as well on her being a net positive for us.
The last topic that I want to bring up on Barrett, and this is something that I have heard some libertarian-ish people really railing against, and this is something that everyone has been talking about and worried about, and it has been the story of the year, which is the lockdowns. Now, there have been some court cases in state and federal courts that have been challenging the lockdowns under various challenges, trying to get injunctions, which are basically the court saying that the governor or whoever would have to stop doing what they're doing. That's what an injunction is. It's an order to stop doing something or to not do something in the future. And so it's interesting because there are a few cases in this web here that are playing into this issue of the legality of the lockdowns. And not only the legality of lockdowns, but the legality of lockdowns in light of, you know, a public health emergency, in light of the police powers of the states to protect health and safety of the population and stuff like that. So these are all different, really, really big legal issues that are going to be coming down the pipe. And I think that over the next handful of years, there's going to be a lot of litigation getting far deeper than we've even gotten into. I mean, we're just scratching the surface of the litigation on these lockdowns. But there's enough here, I think, to give a beginning kind of look into Barrett and how she views this stuff. And I've heard some libertarian people really railing against her on this. And I don't think it's as bad. I don't think I'll tip my hand here and I say I don't think that she's great on this issue, but I don't think she's any worse than the other things and the other judges that have been pontificating on this. Mm-hmm. So I'll start by saying that in 1905, there was a case in the Supreme Court called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, one of the most abominable cases in the history of the Supreme Court, where in Jacobson, there was a smallpox outbreak in a town in Massachusetts. And Jacobson, the plaintiff, sued the state for a law or an ordinance or some type of executive order made by the city, I believe, which forced him to get vaccinated for smallpox. And he didn't want to. And he claimed, he made a few different claims that, and one of them was that his 14th Amendment right to liberty had been infringed without due process. And so basically what the court ruled in Jacobson was that under the police power of the state, the city was justified in the forced vaccination for the health and public safety. And there were a few other reasons, but they said stuff like, well, you know, these facts are changing on the ground. There needs to be, you know, in a quickly changing situation like this, the executive authorities need to have great latitude to make these kind of decisions. And so basically what the court said was that, you know, it gave broad police powers to infringe on our liberties, to our bodies, in the name of public health. And so, yeah, the court said that there was no 14th Amendment due process or equal protection violation here. And so I think that this is very dangerous. You know, I'm not going to pontificate on the science of vaccinations. I'm not a doctor. I know nothing about that. All I'm saying is that it's very, very dangerous when the state can force you to do something like that. You know what I mean? And especially at a time like this when there's so much hysteria over the public health emergency that people would, you know, be calling for all these crazy measures to infringe on our liberties that, you know, we don't know where that's going to end up and where that trail leads us.
And also, like, if they can rule on, you know, that our bodies need to be vaccinated, then what else can they rule for our bodies? It sets a bad precedent is what it does.
Right. And it also kind of seems to go against some of the ideas underlying like Roe versus Wade that we talked about before. Right. Well, it's like, well, if you have bodily autonomy to abortion, and one of the main justifications that more conservative people give for at least regulations, if not full out bans on abortion, well, they say, well, it's for public health. They say that abortions are dangerous. They say that, you know, there are complications. They say that, you know, other kind of mental public health things that go into getting an abortion and the hard decision that it is to make that decision. This is some of the arguments that the people who want to at least regulate or ban abortion, this is one of the arguments they make. So if they're making that public health argument, but the court is going the opposite direction, then why would they go with the public health argument here?
Yeah.
When it's basically the same kind of thing. Now, I understand that there's a difference between a communicable disease and a abortion, because abortion doesn't directly affect another person's life other than the fetus's. And then that gets into the, you know, the whole thing about whether the fetus has rights or not, which I don't want to get into here. But it's just an interesting kind of issue to think about how, you know, this relationship between public health and the police power of the state to regulate this kind of stuff. And I think that it's just a very, very dangerous slippery slope when the government is allowed to force us to vaccinate. And I will say that in Jacobson, the penalty for not getting vaccinated was a fine. It was like $20 or something. So that's a distinguishing thing that I think that if if forced vaccinations were to come down the pipe in the near future, I think the it'd be more than a $20 fine. Let's put it like that, for not getting vaccinated. So that might lead to a different outcome in any case coming down the pipe as far as that goes. But anyway, so laying down Jacobson, that's there. And Jacobson is in the precedent, and it's in the court's jurisprudence, and it's accepted. And up to this point, Jacobson has not been overruled. Recently, there was a case in the Supreme Court called South Bay, I believe it was a Pentecostal church, South Bay Pentecostal Church versus Newsom. And in that case, a church in California was suing the governor, Gavin Newsom, and they were saying that his lockdown policies violated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, because he said that, oh, we're going to allow, well, basically what happened was that he had stronger protocols against churches than he did against comparable secular establishments like bars, restaurants, other things like that. So what the church brought suit, and basically were looking for an injunction to preclude the enforcement of that, and they were basically saying they weren't challenging his authority to make the lockdowns in the first place. What they were challenging was that there was a violation of the First Amendment because of the asymmetrical application to religious versus secular institutions, because the secular institutions were not held to as high of a standard as the religious institutions. They said that violated their free exercise clause. So that was their argument in that case. And the court ruled in favor of the governor. Yeah, so they say that, quote, our Constitution principally entrusts the safety and the health of the people to the politically accountable officials of the states to guard and protect. When those officials undertake to act in areas fraught with medical and scientific uncertainties, their latitude must be especially broad. Where those broad limits are not exceeded, they should not be subject to second-guessing by an unelected federal judiciary, which lacks the background, competence, and experience to assess public health and is not accountable to the people. That is especially true where here a party seeks emergency relief in an interlocutory posture, which basically just means in the middle of a lawsuit rather than on the final merits of the case at the end, because they were just in the middle of the lawsuit. They were seeking an injunction. They weren't seeking a final ruling on the legality of the law, because you can get an injunction against a legal law, and even if it ends up being legal at the end of the case, if the ruling says that it's legal, an injunction can still be justified if there would be a likelihood of irreparable harm to the party subjected to that law, if the law isn't ruled on in the meantime, right? So it's like, even if the law is legal, if you're going to get irreparable harm, then the court will say, okay, we're going to not apply the law until we rule on it. And so even then, if it's illegal, if they rule that it's legal on the end, the injunction was still valid. So that's what they're ruling on in this case, whether or not to put in place that injunction. Basically they say that it's basically an argument for judicial restraint by the majority. They're saying that, you know, we're not competent to make these public health decisions, so we're just going to leave it up to executive officials on the ground. And then the dissent basically disagrees and basically says, look, we have a free exercise violation here. And so basically under the free exercise clause, there's a standard that says of strict scrutiny that the court has to follow. And basically what that means is that if you're going to put in place restrictions on free exercise of religion, there's a test you have to meet, a two-part test. The first part is that it has to be a compelling government interest. There has to be a compelling government interest in making the law which restricts the exercise of religion. Second, the law has to be narrowly tailored to meet that interest. So this is the this is very high standard that the court is going to look at in free exercise cases. And the dissent basically just says we should apply strict scrutiny. And if we apply strict scrutiny, we see that we have a legitimate and compelling government interest here for public health. But the law isn't narrowly tailored, because there were ways that the executive order could have been made that didn't discriminate against religious organizations as compared to secular organizations. And I agree with the dissent here. I think that there was an unfair double standard in California against these religious institutions. And I think that under this strict scrutiny test, I think that it is clear that there were ways that this executive order could have been put in place that didn't discriminate against the religious institutions. But notice here, the law itself was not at issue, and the court did not rule on the executive order itself. They were only ruling on the injunction issue, and they did not say that this is not a legitimate government purpose. So in a way, even the dissent was in a, they don't, so the majority directly quotes, cites Jacobson, the vaccination case. The majority directly quotes Jacobson, so they're basically kind of affirming it, saying this is what we're going to follow. The dissent doesn't cite to Jacobson, but because they're saying that there's a legitimate government purpose here, they're kind of acceding to it. They're kind of saying, hey, yeah, this is legit government purpose, this public health stuff. So they're not saying that the executive orders were unconstitutional on their own as such, which is something that I would like to see ruled in the near future, hopefully in the next few years when litigation on this issue gets deeper and we really start to see the full destruction that these lockdowns have wrought on our country, on our health and our economy. But that's an issue for another time. So I think it's important to see. I've heard some libertarians say that, oh, well, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Thomas were pushing back against Jacobson and their dissent in this case. And I'm just like, no, they weren't. They were not pushing back against Jacobson at all. All they were saying was that if you're going to do this Jacobson-style public health executive order, it has to be applied equally to comparable religious and secular institutions. That's all they were saying. And so I think that's a little disingenuous of some people to say that you know, the dissent was trying to push against Jacobson here. And so this ties into Barrett's case, where she was touching on this issue. And this was a case called Illinois Republican Party versus Pritzker, where she ruled with the other two judges, I believe. They all agreed, and they cite Jacobson favorably. They cite Jacobson. It's interesting because in this case, Illinois Republican Party versus Pritzker, which was Barrett's case, it's actually the reverse opposite of what happened in California. So in California, the religious institutions were held to a higher standard than the secular institutions. But in this case with Barrett from Illinois, it's reversed. So the secular institutions were held to a higher standard than the religious institutions. The religious institutions were only given recommendations, whereas the secular institutions were given mandatory mandates on people getting together. And so the Illinois Republican Party comes in and they say, hey, you're violating our First Amendment. You're violating our free speech. So this is like the flip of the South Bay Pentecostal Church, where in that case, before the Supreme Court, the religious institution was saying that our free exercise is being violated. And then in Pritzker, the secular institution was saying that our speech was free speech rights were being violated. So it's an interesting flip. But basically, again, it's kind of similar in the way that in this case, Pritzker, which Barrett ruled on, they cite Jacobson favorably for the public health police power stuff, and they say that the order as such was not at issue in the case. Very similar to the other case. Let me see here the exact language. Yes, they say, at this stage in the present litigation, no one is alleging that the governor lacks the power to issue such orders as a matter of state law. Instead, our case presents a more granular challenge to the governor's action, one that focuses on his decision to subject the exercise of religion only to recommended measures rather than mandatory ones. We must decide whether that distinction is permissible. So again, I've heard some libertarians say, oh, she's ruling in favor of Jacobson, and she's saying that these lockdowns were legal on their face, and it's kind of like, no, that's not what she was saying. In this case, they weren't ruling at all on that issue. I mean, they kind of hint to it by citing Jacobson favorably, and earlier in the case, they kind of are leaning towards it, but ultimately they say we're not going to really rule on that because there's a more specific issue at play. And so basically what they end up ruling in the case is that they rule in favor of the governor because the free exercise of the church is speech plus. So it's not just free speech. It's free speech in the exercise of religion, which means that there's more than just speech at issue. Whereas the Illinois GOP, they were only looking for their free speech rights, their political speech rights. So that is why they said that that distinguishes the First Amendment claim by the Illinois GOP and the First Amendment free exercise claim of the church. Because the church has free speech and free exercise, speech plus free exercise, and the GOP only has speech, that distinguishes them. And so therefore, the asymmetry in the way the executive order was instituted and how it was applied, that was okay. The distinguish between the secular and the religious institutions was permissible. So ultimately, I think that we have a very dangerous underlying current of precedent here on what the government can do in the name of public health unilaterally. And we've been seeing very much so that a lot of the things that the government's been doing for public health without much challenge from the courts, abdication by the courts, to not make sure that the government's actually proving that what they're doing is worthwhile and actually going to do things to help, we can see that there's a really dangerous undercurrent here of what the courts will allow these executive authorities to do and what kind of liberties they're going to allow to take from us without true adequate proof and with changing standards and equivocation and all the lying of politics that go into this, especially this recent pandemic. I mean, it's been more politics than science, in my opinion. But Barrett, she's not pushing against any undercurrent against Jacobson. She's going with the same flow that we see from Jacobson and from the South Bay Pentecostal Church, where all of the justices in all of these cases are basically saying that Jacobson is fine. And so she's not siding with Jacobson any more than any of these other justices are. So I think that to point to Jacobson and to see how Barrett has handled Jacobson and to point this out as something that's uniquely bad about her, I think that's ridiculous. I think this might be something that she might be bad on, but she's not going to be any worse or any different from any of the other justices and judges who are at play here.
It also sounds like we don't have enough to judge off of whether she'll be too good or too bad on this alone.
Yeah, and also, you know, the whole point is that once she gets on the court,
yeah,
she's going to be dealing with the other justices, and they're going to be making arguments to her, and she might change her mind. And also, I will say that they haven't gotten to Jacobson directly, like I said, even in that Supreme Court case. They were just accepting Jacobson as value. They were just accepting Jacobson at face value because of the nature of the litigation. But it seems to me that there's nothing there to say that Jacobson won't or couldn't be overturned in the future. Do I think it will be? Probably not. But it hasn't been directly brought up because of the nature of these appeals. I think we're going to have to get much deeper into litigation in the future, in the next few years, before we really see how the court's going to handle Jacobson directly. And I don't think that Barrett has anything there to make us more worried about her than any of the other justices that are already there.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't think there's enough for us to go off of. And all this really public health issues, yes, it's always been a problem, but it's only becoming very apparent to people like us this year alone because of the issues that have come about from this coronavirus hysteria. We've gone on for quite a while now.
Yep, yeah.
And, you know, I think we had some things planned for this episode, but we've decided we're going to wait for another episode.
And we're going to hit the necessary and proper clause. We're going to hit the commerce clause. We're going to hit substantive due process, maybe, and maybe one or two other things. I thought we were going to hit Barrett real quickly and get it over with, but we had some really, really great things to come out here. So I'm really, really happy with how this episode turned out. I would just like to end the episode on one final quote from a case which we read in Judge Napolitano's seminar, and it ties in very nicely to the public health and public emergency kind of things that are going on right now. So I'll just turn it over to you real quick to see if you have any final thoughts on everything we've been talking about, and then I'll wrap it up with this fantastic quote.
No final thoughts, but hey guys, please leave a good review on iTunes or whatever you listen to us on. Shout us out to your friends. Follow us on Twitter.
And also, if you want, join our Discord.
Yeah, we have a new Discord, so check that out. You can come communicate with me and David. But yeah, guys, we just appreciate y'all, and y'all's support means the world to us. But go ahead, Dave.
All right. So I have a quote here to end our discussion on from Justice Sutherland in his dissent in 1934 in the case Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell. And I'm quoting Justice Sutherland. "A provision of the Constitution, it is hardly necessary to say, does not admit of two distinctly opposite interpretations. It does not mean one thing at one time and an entirely different thing at another time. If the contract impairment clause, when framed and adopted, meant that the terms of a contract for the payment of money could not be altered in invitum by a state statute enacted for the relief of hardly pressed debtors to the end and with the effect of postponing payment or enforcement during and because of an economic or financial emergency, it is but to state the obvious to say that it means the same now. This view, at once so rational in its application to the written word and so necessary to the stability of constitutional principles, though from time to time challenged, has never, unless recently, been put within the realm of doubt by the decisions of this court. The true rule was forcefully declared in Ex parte Milligan, in the face of circumstances of national peril and public unrest and disturbance far greater than any that exist today. In that great case, this court said that the provisions of the Constitution there under consideration had been expressed by our ancestors in such plain English words that it would seem the ingenuity of man could not evade them, but that after the lapse of more than 70 years, they were sought to be avoided. Those great and good men, the court said, foresaw that troublous times would arise when rules and people would become restive under restraint and seek by sharp and decisive measures to accomplish ends deemed just and proper, and that the principles of constitutional liberty would be in peril unless established by irrepealable law. The history of the world had taught them that what was done in the past might be attempted in the future, and then, in words the power and truth of which have become increasingly evident with the lapse of time, there was laid down the rule without which the Constitution would cease to be the supreme law of the land, binding equally upon governments and governed at all times and under all circumstances, and become a mere collection of political maxims to be adhered to or disregarded according to the prevailing sentiment of the legislative and judicial opinion in respect to the supposed necessities of the hour. The Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and in peace, and covers with the shield of its protection all classes of men at all times and under all circumstances. No doctrine involving more pernicious consequences was ever invented by the wit of man than that any of its provisions can be suspended during any of the great exigencies of government. Such a doctrine leads directly to despotism. And with that, I'd like to say thank you, everybody, for listening to the Law of Liberty podcast, and we'll see you again soon.